Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome to another Trademark podcast. I'm Stefan the Newline and I'm joined today by two comrades, Maria Lacan and Tanya Nijmeijer. I'm going to let them introduce themselves in a minute. Mariella was an advisor to the FARC on international relations during the peace process recently. She was obviously, as we know her, the former director of Justice for Colombia, which is a British and Irish trade union backed organization, which tries to support and lobby for the protection of human rights and trade union rights and peace in Colombia. We know her, of course, in Ireland from her an initiative that she actually instigated and led to engage actors within the Irish peace process, to engage with your equivalents, I suppose, in Colombia, to share their experiences with the Colombian peace negotiators. And she's now the international officer at the TUC in London. We're also really pleased to have with us today Tanya Nijmeijer, originally from the Netherlands. In 2002, she joined in with the guerrilla forces of FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. From 2012, she was part of the negotiation team at the beginning of the peace process between the government and the guerrilla forces, much of which, of course, facilitated by and happened in Cuba. After the signing of the peace agreement, she lived in a transition area for reincorporation of ex-combatants. Currently, she's doing a PhD as well at University of the Basque Country. I look forward to reading that when it comes out as a book. And currently works for the reintegration of ex-combatants in Colombia. And we're really going to be talking about some of that work today. For those of you who know or follow our podcast, you'll have listened, of course, to podcast number 33, where Mariella spoke previously, believe it or not, 18 months ago. And we kind of got an update on the peace process in Colombia, but also we looked at the links between and really comparisons between the Irish and Colombian peace process. It's very different in scale and context, obviously. But the one thing that kind of linked them was this: they're both characterized by what you might call pax neoliberal, you know, peace processes that had much on offer, but delivered less. And in fact, both, you could argue, have taken place largely under the influence of market-led forces and you know, and within a kind of broadly neoliberal framework. And in Colombia, of course, Duque has continued with that kind of economic transition, but it also seems, and we're going to hear today from Mariella and Tanya about that, he's reneged on other parts, significant parts of the peace process. And of course, we see an increasingly authoritarian government there and continuing violence against activists and against social leaders, not least ex-combatants of the FARC. But before we get into all of that, I'm going to ask our comrades to tell us a little bit more about themselves, their background in Colombia, particularly, I suppose, their involvement in the peace process, because I know that's an important part of your own history as friends together. So, Mariella, I'm going to go to you first. You can kick us off. Give us a bit of a background in what you got up to in that peace process. Anything you can tell us, obviously, because this is going out on a public platform.
Thanks, Stevie, and thank you for the invitation to the podcast again. And it's just brilliant to be sharing this space with Tanya, who I got to know during the peace negotiations, and we became, you know, great friends and also worked together. So it's really great to be doing this with her. My background, as you mentioned, so in terms of Justice for Colombia, I used to run that campaign, which was a campaign set up by trade unions. And we always had a focus, obviously, on supporting trade unions and activists in Colombia and human rights work, but also always pushing for a negotiated political solution to the conflict. Back in 2006, 2007, we did a lot of work around pushing for the conditions for a peace process. And we started building interest in Ireland between cross-party sectors and unions in sharing experiences, and began taking Colombian peace leaders even before the start of talks to Belfast to start sharing experiences. When the peace process was formally publicly announced, we organised a group of cross-party figures that had been involved in the talks and unions to go and meet civil society and meet the Colombian president and the government negotiators. But we were always very clear that we needed to treat the FARC as an equal party at the negotiating table and give them access. So we took the first ever international delegation to Havana to meet with the FARC negotiators. And we began a series of exchanges with Irish actors, South African actors, sharing those experiences. I then was asked to kind of be seconded over as an advisor to the FARC in the negotiations. And it was really at the time of the negotiations when the FARC were talking about the UN verifying their disarmament and verifying other elements of the peace agreement. And it was seen that, you know, the FARC needed to have access to be able to share their perspectives with the UN. So I was brought in to kind of be the line of communication with the UN Security Council, members of the council, advise on the negotiations around Chapter 6 of the agreement, which is all about the international kind of verification and support for the peace process. And then once the agreement was signed, I was based in Bogota, advising in the kind of post-agreement negotiations and supporting the negotiations with the government about implementation and liaising with the UN and going regularly to meet with members of the Security Council. And really there, our focus was making sure that all the things that were happening that were, you know, problematic were being raised, but also that the UN mission's mandate, as well as the disarmament, was also, you know, looking at the reincorporation and the safety of former combatants. And yeah, it's a lot to explain quickly, but
thanks for mentioning the reincorporation and those aspects of the peace process, because we really want to talk about those today. But over to you, Tanya, tell us a little bit about your involvement in the peace processes over the last number of years then.
Yeah, okay. So I came out of the jungle in 2012. I went to the jungle in 2003. So that's when I was taken to Havana to the peace talks. Within the peace talks, during the first part of the negotiation, which was about rural reform, I was one of the 10 negotiators who was sitting actually at the negotiating table. After rural reform, after more or less 1 year, I stopped being at the negotiation table and I went to be part of the gender subcommission in Havana, which I did until the end. Like we created a gender subcommission who had to incorporate a gender focus to the agreements. I think it's the first agreement worldwide that has a gender focus as such. Like in all the points of the agreement, there's a gender focus. And I was part of the communication team in Havana. And I also did a lot of press stuff, like in relationships with the international press. And I was part of the commission, which had to get miners to get away from the FARC camps before the peace agreement was signed. So I also did that. Afterwards, in 2016, the peace agreement was signed. Then I came to Colombia and I started living in a transition zone in Cauca, in the west of Colombia, in the north of Cauca, with 350, 400 ex-fighters who were all living in that zone. I was in charge. I was part of the leadership of the transitional zone, and I was in charge of education for our people. And I also was in charge of getting identity cards for all the ex-fighters, which was a really difficult process. But I think most of us have identity cards right now. And after 1 year, more or less, armed groups, the conflict was starting again in the territory. So armed groups were getting very close to the zone. People were started to get killed. So that's when we decided to leave the transitional zone, which was a tough decision because in Havana, I think we all thought about those zones like this is going to be the example of what we want for Colombia. Yeah, we're going to create cooperative economic enterprises to show people what we want, solidarity. So everything failed, or at least in our zone. So that was a tough decision. We came to the city. Then we started, me and my boyfriend, we started to study at the university again. That's when I decided to do a master's degree. And right now I'm going to start a PhD, like you've already said. When we came to the city, that's when I started to work with Mariela in the implementation commission in Bogota, which I did for some 2 years. Then I decided Mariela left. So... And I didn't immediately resign when Mariela left, but it was like she was an important support for me, in the implementation commission. But the real reason was that I decided to leave the FARC party I think because of political differences with the leadership of the FARC party. So I decided to leave. And that's when I also decided to leave the implementation commission. And afterwards, I started to be more involved with the economic reintegration of ex-combatants. Like, I think we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to get onto that in a minute. Thanks for raising that subject, but also thanks for drawing attention to that gender focus of the peace process. We wanted to talk about that as well later on, because for anyone looking from the West into Colombia, the FARC were always kind of well known for female fighters and female combatants. But I know that you wanted to talk, and Mariela also, about the specific challenges that former combatants face when they're trying to reintegrate or reincorporate themselves into those collective zones, those transition zones. The next question is, it's a really simple question, but it's a massive answer. So try and limit your answer to remember, you're talking to people who know fuck all about what's going on in Colombia for the most part. So, and the small question is, how's the peace process going after 5 years? I mean, I remember, I know it's a difficult question to answer. I remember at the time, the energy and excitement. And I watched particularly Mariela, because I knew her then, you know, on social media. And it seemed at the time to promise so much, you know, and there was so much excitement and energy built up around that period. Where are we now, Mariela? I'll go to you first.
It is a huge question. And I think you're right. The hope and the excitement that I certainly felt in Havana, and I know a lot of us felt in Havana, a lot of that, you know, has been dampened with some of the difficult and painful things that have happened. But I also think, I don't think anyone was naive as to the struggle that it would be to get that agreement implemented, because that agreement, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't dismantle neoliberalism, but it does have transformative potential, and it has real potential to create structural change. So I think if we look at what's been implemented, you know, firstly, there's a lot you could go into the historical reasons as to why it's not been implemented. And obviously, we don't have time to get into all of that kind of analysis of what happened. But I think if you think you had a far right government that opposed the peace process, elected now almost 4 years ago, to then, you know, rely on that government to implement the agreement is difficult, even though under the previous government, there were already a lot of challenges with the government that had actually negotiated the peace agreement. But I think one key thing to point out is, when we're looking at this, is one, that the FARC did comply with their obligations. And, you know, Dania can speak more about that, but the FARC complied with what it signed up to. And I think if you look at what's been least implemented, it really is the chapters that deal with the root causes of the conflict. So the issue around rural reform that Dania can speak to, she negotiated that chapter, the chapter around political participation, those things that really target the causes have been the least implemented. And I also think other areas have been, you know, distorted in its transition from an agreement to legislation. I just wanted to say two more things, and then I think, you know, it's important to hear Dania's perspective. But I think, obviously, the huge amount of killings, which I know we're going to go on to, of former combatants and of activists and leaders is a huge, you know, issue in terms of the implementation. But I do think we also need to recognize some of the positives in terms of that agreement being an agreement that will outlive, you know, this administration. That's an agreement that is there, that belongs to the Colombian people. There still has, like, that transformative potential is still there. And I think the recent mobilizations and huge strikes that you're seeing and demonstration is a result of that peace process and people feeling emboldened. And you know, one of the key demands of the strikes was to implement the agreement. There's been a kind of new mobilization on the left, and even people that have never been organized. And I think all of that you can trace to the peace agreement and that opening up of democratic space, which was one of our key, everyone's aim in that, despite the repression, the killings, you know, and we have to look at all of that. But I would just say it's important to also hold on to the future and what has been achieved and the amount of lives that have been saved as well. That, you know, often you're looking at the killings, but also the lives that all those people in conflict had to go through. I'll end there. So I think there's a lot to say, so it's difficult. No,
look, I know it's a ridiculous question, really, asking you where a peace process is after 5 years, and asking you to sum it all up in 2 minutes. But that's the challenge of a podcast, Mariela. I'm sorry, you just have to get with it, you know. But you've done well there. Well done. All right. Tanya, over to you. What would you give me some feelings that you have about 5 years into this peace process and where you are? Mariela ended on some positives there, saying, look, a democratic space has opened up in Colombia. There have been positive changes, notwithstanding the election of almost a far right government a few years ago, which have stymied the peace process. But Is it where you expected to be, or were you, like Mariella said, were you not so naive at the start that you knew it would be a massive challenge?
We were not naive in the sense that we knew that we were not going to achieve a revolution at the negotiation table in Havana. You know, a negotiation is always like compromises between two parts. And we knew that it was not like the what Mariella said, the neoliberal, an attack to the neoliberal system. And it was always clear at the table as well. Like the government had very clear red lines like this. We're not going to speak about the mining exploitation in Colombia. We're not going to speak about economic politics from the government. You know, we're not going to speak about neoliberal politics. That was clear at the table. But I do think that we, at least ex-fighters, we expected the government we were negotiating with at the table. They were convinced of the fact that Colombia needed some transformations, especially at the countryside, but also transformations in terms of political participation. And we felt that was sincere, you know, but I think it was one part of the elites we were sitting with at the negotiation table in Havana. And now another part, elites, is in power in Colombia. And it is clear that they don't want those transformations that are established within the peace agreement. So I think that with this government, and Mariela also said that there's no reason for optimism. But I do think there are elections shortly in Colombia. So I do think the peace agreement opens up the door for transformations. And if a government is being elected who really is committed to the peace agreement, it might be the peace agreement might be saved, might be implemented in Colombia, you know. But there's some things that are already, I think, destroyed of the peace agreement. Like Mariela said, there were some points of the agenda which attack causes of the conflict. There are other points of the agenda which attack consequences of the conflict, like victims, like implementation. But there are also causes of the conflict, like drug trafficking, like a drug, like coca, like rural reform, like political participation. And I think all those points are interconnected, yeah. You know, and some of the main failures of the implementation is that everything had to be implemented if you wanted everything to work, you know. It had to be, there had to be some integrality of the peace agreement, and I think that integrality is lost.
The other thing, the other thing, of course, that's Mariela mentioned already, that's holding back parts of the implementation, I suppose, particularly in the reincorporation zones, is the level of killings and the level of murders and assassinations by the right at the moment. I mean, Colombia is clearly still a really dangerous place to be if you're a left activist, if you're a social leader. I mean, even if environmental activists are being murdered in Colombia, a lot of people in the West don't understand or even realize that, let alone if you're a former combatant of the FARC. And the violence which has characterized the last number of years clearly is continuing into 2022, as we've seen in January with assassinations, massacres, and so on. Mariela, how bad is it? And what's the prognosis for that?
It's like extreme in such a horrific way, you know, and I think it's really hard because you list numbers and then you have to remember each person, each number has an organization, has a political process, has a family, you know, each one represents a struggle that is also damaged. It's not just that life taken, and that's why they're systematic and targeted. But in terms of former combatants, obviously, Dania can speak to it, but, you know, more than 300 have been murdered. Just the last one was just days ago, you know. And in terms of leaders, the estimates are different. Some human rights organizations are reporting, like, you know, well over 1,200 leaders since the signing of the agreement just over 5 years ago. And I think we saw also, you know, the police repression, the riot police repression during the strikes last year. You know, it's interesting because some of the Irish people that we took to Havana spoke about the, you know, the police reforms and what had happened with the PSNI. And that was one area that, again, wasn't it, Daniel, like a red line? The government didn't want to touch reforming the security services, reforming that doctrine of you know, the internal enemy. And I think we're seeing that with how the police respond to a strike, you know, and to demonstrations, shooting dead over 40 protesters, allegedly, you know, that. So I think there's something very, you know, structural and fundamental. And obviously there's the lack of implementation of the whole, you know, approach to dismantling paramilitary groups.
Yeah, it was. Thanks for that. I mean, I think it was September 9th, was it? The September 9th protest in 2020, where you referred to, which showed that the police and the state were complicit in attacking and that killing was, and murdering.
Yeah, and then last year there was months again when people were shot dead.
Tanya, in the case of former FARC combatants, I mean, how obviously it's difficult. I appreciate it's really difficult to speak about it, but how is the security situation regarding the former combatants?
Yeah, for us, it's a very difficult situation. More than 300 ex-fighters have been assassinated since the signing of the peace agreement. And like Mariela said, that they are people, they're not just numbers. They're people from our community, people who were also social leaders, you know, in on the countryside. And like for us, it's very painful for those people to be killed, especially because there's supposed to be peace. We signed a peace agreement. We feel committed to peace. And it feels like people are being shot in the back, you know. Last week, the Constitutional Court in Colombia decided that the attitude of the government, I don't know if I say this well, but that the measures taken by the government to protect the lives of ex-combatants are insufficient and unconstitutional. So that's an important decision for us because they back us in the sense that we've always said that the government isn't doing enough to protect our lives, you know. They only focus on security guards, like to have security cars and bodyguards and stuff like that, but that's not enough. They don't do anything about stigmatization, for example. They don't do anything about rolling back the stigmatization they promoted during so many years of war, you know, and right now they should do something to roll back that stigmatization. They don't. So that's also one of the causes, I think, of so many people being killed. And you can't just only concentrate on security because that's not enough. You have to like be more preventive with the security of ex-combatants.
Yeah, I get what you mean about the stigmatization of ex-combatants and the kind of the government spending 40 years dehumanizing combatants, so that when the peace process comes around, it's easier to kill someone if you don't think they're a human being. And clearly that's the attitude amongst many of the right-wing and right-wing paramilitaries and those in the state that are complicit with those murders. But I mean, I suppose the next thing, in the midst of some of that horror and that state complicity and Duque's refusal to actually implement so much of the peace process, people are still, as you said, genuinely trying to implement aspects of that peace process. As you said, they're committed to it. And central to that was what you spoke about in terms of transition zones and that process of collective reincorporation. And can you say a little bit about your perspective on that, the importance of that collective reincorporation and what it meant to you and what it means to you? Because I know you tried so hard, FARC tried so hard to make sure that it was central to the peace agreement. And also maybe throw in at the end there what the idea of what the role of cooperatives play in that process, because that's really interesting to us because we're involved in it on a very small scale, something similar here in the north of Ireland. Tell us a little bit about that, Tanya.
That's a lot of questions. First of all, I'm going to say something about collective reincorporation and why we use the word reincorporation. Like in Havana, we were when the topic of reintegration of ex-combatants came up, for us, it was clear that we didn't want like to follow the traditional DDR, like disarmament, demobilization and reintegration. We wanted, because that's very individual. You know, that's an individual reintegration of ex-combatants. Like, here you have some money. We're going to give you some education so you can get a job, find a job for yourself and your family and just build up a new life as a new individual citizen. In Havana, we thought that we wanted to do it differently. And also because of like looking at best experiences all over the world, it's not like individual reintegration programs have been very successful, you know? So that's why we wanted to have a collective reintegration. Finally, the government, of course, wanted an individual reintegration. And finally, the peace agreement has from both reintegrations, it has some elements, you know, there's some elements of collective and some elements of individual reintegration. One of those elements of individual reintegration that is in the peace agreement is, for example, the monthly subsidies we receive from the government. We also received a bigger subsidy, like 2,000 euros to set up some enterprise, but also the peace agreement has some elements of collective reintegration, and one of those elements is Ecomun. Ecomun was a cooperative created by the peace agreement, and it was supposed to receive all the money, all those subsidies, those 2,000 euro subsidies from all ex-combatants, and set up a collective, a very big cooperative enterprise, you know, and Ecomun would be like the mother cooperative of all cooperatives in Colombia. So at this moment, Ecomun exists, but there are some decisions that have been made by the government and I don't know, also by the FARC, I think, which have been obstacles to the development of Ecomun. Ecomun exists. There are 7,000 ex-combatants who are member of Ecomun. There are like 150, 140 cooperatives who are member of Ecomun at this moment. So that's a lot. But for example, one of the problems we have is that Ecomun didn't receive the money that it was supposed to receive. It didn't. It's actually functioning because of international cooperation. And that was not the idea, the initial idea. You know, it didn't receive the money. The money was sent to the governmental agency for reincorporation. They're very bureaucratic. I think a lot of money gets lost. So I think that's an important aspect nobody ever talks about, you know? The government just decided like the money isn't going to Ecomun. I don't know why. It's like also very patronizing, I think, like you can't receive the money because you're not capable of doing something good with it. So it's going to a governmental agency. You know, if you don't have money to set up productive projects, it's very difficult to develop something like that.
Yeah, it's nearly impossible. I mean, we know under capitalism, it's, you know, capital has capital when it employs labor, but cooperatives are labor looking for capital to start their enterprises. And if the capital is not there, it's almost impossible to do anything. Mariella, can you talk a little bit, maybe, because Tanya referenced it there, that the attitude of the government is important here, isn't it, in terms of that reincorporation process and what they've been doing or not doing?
I think from the beginning of the implementation, we saw this different vision, didn't we? Because the FARC talked about reincorporation as socioeconomic, but also political and legal. And, you know, that political reincorporation is what I don't think they wanted, you know, an organized political reincorporation as well into political life, but also just the ideas that I remember the FARC talking about in terms of, you know, the transition zones eventually becoming communities and all that integration with local communities, because the FARC aren't separate to the rest of society, you know. And so I think that was really damaged by a lot of the delays. I think, yeah, lack of will and also a lack, even just on the level of competence. You know, we, just to give you an anecdote, the last guerrilla conference was in a place called La Diamante, where the FARC still as a guerrilla organization had to approve internally the agreement, didn't it? And we went there and they built a whole village pretty much out of bamboo in 13 days, you know, sustainable, well-built. And I remember, you know, in the initial days of the reincorporation, there was a lot of negotiations around the materials and giving, you know, the former combatants the empowered, you know, ownership over building the zones and making them sustainable. And instead, I mean, Dania, come in if I get anything wrong, but instead it was, you know, tin and materials that weren't suitable to a lot of the areas, the weather, they weren't sustainable, they'd flood or get really hot, or, you know, and actually having, you know, that patronizing approach instead of actually a lot of the FARC former combatants knowing much better what would work to create a sustainable place to live and a dignified project. And just to add as well, I think the, like Dania said, you know, a lot of the problems around the funding, around titles to land to develop projects on was huge obstacles. And the successes are down to the former combatants' initiatives, you know, to their work, to their grind, this tendency, and the international community and the UN, which is supported, but the tendency of wanting to control the resources. We saw it in every aspect, didn't we? Because when we were working on the international support for the implementation, beyond just the reincorporation, but other projects we were designing around, you know, other kinds of projects, and we were negotiating with the government the protocols around how international support for projects would be managed, the insistence on them centralized, you know, controlling where the money comes and then them allocating it. I used to think if they were at least competent, that would be one thing. But the combination of incompetence, corruption, you know, at some levels locally and regionally, and then not delivering was, yeah, it was really difficult to see that waste, because I think so much could have been done.
And yet in that context, many of those cooperatives are still functioning and still trying their best and still creating wealth for former combatants and for local communities. It'd be interesting to see how that pans out over the next sort of couple of years, I suppose. One of the things you mentioned earlier that we wanted to talk about before we finish up is I know that some of those cooperatives are women only. Many of them are led by women. But it also you also wanted to talk about that the specific challenges, I suppose, that that women faced, women former combatants faced in that reincorporation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Tanya?
Yeah, I think like there are a lot of challenges, especially for women, you know, because, you know, within the guerrillas, there wasn't like total equality and there was machismo as well. And of course, all the bad things from society would be reflected within the guerrilla forces. But we did have more a level of equality with men than in the outside world. You know, in Colombia, it's very it's a very traditional country. People are very Catholic here, which means that they have sometimes conservative ideas about what the role of women should be. Women should be at home. They should have children. And I think for us, for many women, female ex-fighters, that has been difficult. You know, the stigmatization and also discrimination of female ex-fighters is much more than for male ex-fighters, you know. For a woman, it's like not, how do you say that, not imperdonable, Mariela, help me please.
It's unforgivable.
It's unforgivable to have carried a weapon, you know, and to have been part of a war. And for a man, of course, it's also, they're also stigmatized, you know, but less because they're a man and they're machos and they have been at a war. So they are very brave. But women aren't, you know, because you, where were you? You had to stay home. You had to have children. You had to take care of your husband and you didn't. So that's something that's in the communities. It's difficult to manage, you know, and after the signing of the peace agreement, there was a big baby boom. And of course, that's nice. It's nice that people have babies if they want to have babies. But sometimes I also feel that I don't know, because I can speak for other female ex-fighters, but sometimes I feel that it's also like to fulfill the expectations of a society who wants us to have children. And I don't know. And yeah, you can see in a lot of zones that women are taking leading roles. But recently we had a big meeting of female ex-fighters from all over the country. And one of the big problems they felt was that they have a family now and that they are like being pushed to the private sphere. Like you're not going to be in the public sphere anymore. Like you're not going to do politics and you're not going to be a leader in a cooperative, you know, because you have to be at home with your children. And they have like this kind of difficulties when they want to do enterprise, when they want to have their cooperatives working. So I can see some examples of some very positive examples of women who are actually being leaders in the communities and who are doing politics and women who are taking the leading role in things. But I also see a lot of negative examples of women who stay at home and who really don't feel like very comfortable with it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You get this contradiction or this tension between these iconic photographs you see, particularly of armed revolutionary forces with women carrying weaponry versus the reality of their lives in traditional society and how those two things clash. Mariela, did you want to come in on that one too? Because I know that that gender aspect of the peace process, Tanya's already said it, it's really unique, isn't it?
I think it really is. And I think, you know, Tanya and other women, all the women that put into that process and the women's organizations that, you know, also supported it. I think it's so important to highlight that aspect of the peace agreement because it's so groundbreaking. And I think, you know, what Dania touched on about women who have been in armed struggle not being forgiven is so important. We did a session in Havana with former women combatants from many countries. And it was a theme that came up and again and again. And I think if you look at the media treatment of the women peace negotiators, like Dania, like other ones, it's like the agency was constantly being questioned of whatever you think of the decision, you know, to join that group. It's like someone had to have been someone's lover or someone, you know, it was always, wasn't it? Women were kind of, their agency and deciding to be in that situation was always kind of diminished. And I think the kind of feminist thought and that class-based feminism, that feminist thought that you developed in the peace negotiations and that the women developed was so important, because it also, you know, that slogan that the women had of "we're not swapping our weapons to pick up the broom." And I think that was a really kind of powerful message, and it really speaks to what Danielle's speaking about now in terms of that transition and the particular challenges that the women former combatants face, and I think the need for the international community to do more to show solidarity with the women in that situation.
Yeah, the really interesting, the fight against imperialism is one thing, but the fight against patriarchy is eternal. That's always there as a challenge. Look, we're kind of coming to the end here. I wanted to finish on one question, which is kind of a broad question to round us up. And you mentioned, Mariela, before the importance of, in Colombia, of the peace process, at least opening up that democratic space. So there's some space at least for potential, you know, radical and progressive change. I suppose I was interested in that. What's the extent of that, I suppose, in terms of that wider social mobilization about support from social movements, from indigenous groups, from peasant organizations, from the trade union movement? Do you see that coming together? Do you see that offering an alternative? Do you see that being able to at least kind of provide a bulwark or some sort of resistance against Duque, against this really right-wing government? And is there hope in the next elections for some change? I'll come to you first, Tanya, and then Mariela after.
I am very positive about the upcoming elections. I do think the peace agreement opened up the door for social protests. You know, at least there's no way the government can accuse the protesters of being managed by the guerrilla forces, which is also positive. You know, and people just went onto the streets, especially here in Cali, where I live. It was like the epicenter of all the social protests, and people just went onto the streets, and they didn't care about what the media or what the government would say about them. And I think that's very important. I think that's also a consequence of the peace agreement. And I also think that for the elections, I don't know, I'm positive about the elections. I think an alternative government who wants to implement the peace agreement is going to take over. But I'm not so positive in the sense that the economic power will be in the hands of the same people, you know, and that might be quite dangerous, you know, in a country. It's something we have also seen in Venezuela. It's very easy for elites, if they have the economic power, like to do whatever they need to do to show that it's not working, you know, that this government isn't working. But okay, that's the future, you know. First of all, let's wait for the elections and let's see if changes are coming up, which is what Colombia so much needs.
Yeah, we often refer to it here, and also I heard it referred to in South Africa as a double transition. You get this kind of welcome transition from conflict or war to some sort of relative peace, but you also get this other transition, which is from forms of, you know, maybe social democracy, certainly in the north of Ireland here, to actually full-blown neoliberalism. And that second economic transition is vital, isn't it, to any success, which is why I suppose in the context you're in, that coming together of social movements and trade unions and political parties is so crucial. Mariela, do you have any positivity for the next short while?
Yeah, I mean, I never tire of being inspired by the struggle of the people of Colombia. I think we have so much to learn from them. I mean, in the current the violence, the repression they face, and still they're organizing, they're mobilizing. The model in Colombia has always, you know, been imposed through violence. And I think Tanya's right that challenge, but I do think the mobilizations we've seen in the last 2 years have been quite unprecedented in terms of new young people being engaged. I think the level of participation in the elections is really important, and tapping into so many young people that might not have been voting in the past. But I also think whatever happens, even if a progressive candidate does win, that mobilization and organizing, you know, needs to accompany that to give that support to any changes. And we have seen a wave of change for the better more recently in Latin America. And I just hope Colombia is part of that, because this government has, you know, trampled on a historic opportunity with the peace process. And like I said, that agreement belongs to the people of Colombia. So yeah, I'm always hopeful, because otherwise, I wouldn't have. Yeah, I'm always hopeful. I think they, and I think also we need to build solidarity.
We'll leave solidarity as our final word, would we? That's a good word to finish with, and that's what we need to see. And I agree with Marilyn that the left in the West needs to look a lot more to Latin America instead of into its own belly button from time to time if it wants to know what needs to be done to challenge the forces of capital globally and the forces of imperialism. Look, thanks very much, Mariella, for coming back on our podcast for the second time. Tanya, thank you very much from over there all the way in Colombia. Our signal didn't fall down, which is great. It's the first time that's happened for a while. I'd love to get you back on again. I know there's lots more to talk about. And until then, thanks very much. And slango fall and adios.
Thanks for inviting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and slango fall.